Hi, I'm Chris Irwin. Welcome to The Come Up, a podcast that interviews entrepreneurs and leaders.
I'm shocked any of this worked. So much of what we built was theoretical for so long. And the fact that there's almost no greater feeling than watching the moment a theory becomes a fact. We were making stand-up specials at scale, 20 to 30 a year, for years, spending millions and millions of dollars. We didn't know if it would work or not, probably until year 7. We started this plan in 08, and I didn't know it would work, for sure, until 2014.
This week's episode features Brian Volk-Weiss, the founder and CEO of the Nacelle Company. Brian grew up in Queens with an early love for the Star Wars and 1989 Batman films. But upon realizing these worlds weren't based on reality, but instead imagined through the magic of Hollywood, Brian fell in love with filmmaking. So after college in Iowa, he moved to LA to become a production assistant. He then took an early career bet on producing a catalog of stand-up comedy specials, which almost bankrupted him. But the bet paid off big and enabled Brian to found his own production company, which is behind hit titles like The Movies That Made Us on Netflix. So Brian exudes an incredible love for his work, as well as constant amazement he's got to where he is today, which makes telling his story really fun. Some highlights of our chat include why comedians are geniuses, empathy in content production, doing Netflix's first streamer deal, toy shopping as therapy, and why he'll retire when his first feature film is greenlit. All right, let's get to it. Brian, thanks for being on the Come Up podcast.
Thank you for having me. Very honored.
Awesome. Let's rewind a bit. And why don't you start with telling us where you grew up and what your household was like?
I grew up in Queens, New York. I was born in the late 70s. It was my mom, my dad, and me, and that's it.
And early on, when did this love for toys, entertainment, storytelling, when did that really come to be? Was there a glimpse in your preteen years or as you were growing up in your house, any inspirations from your parents?
I got to give my mom credit because at 3 years old, I could not have bought my own ticket to Star Wars. So I guess I can give her credit for my whole career in that regard. But I'm very lucky. It's the luckiest thing in the world. I saw Star Wars when I was 3 and I was so young. And by the way, everything I'm about to tell you, I have no memory of whatsoever, but my mom told this story her entire life. Yeah. So I have it memorized. But basically, at 3 years old, I did not know the word documentary. But basically, the way my mom described my reaction to seeing Star Wars, it was as though I thought it was a documentary. Because after that, and you have to understand, my mom was one of the first women to get a PhD from St. John. My dad was a lawyer. Like it was very concerning to them that their son, for months, when he was asked, hey, what do you want to do when you grow up? My answer was like, I want to fly an X-Wing fighter. I want to join the rebellion. I mean, this really freaked my parents out.
Yeah.
So my mom bought me this book that I still have that was about the making of Star Wars, but it's written for 5-year-olds. And, you know, I opened the book. The Death Star that was supposed to be the size of the moon was only 6 feet across. C-3PO, there was a picture of his helmet off, and it's Anthony Daniels. From that moment, and by the way, before that, I wanted to be a limousine driver, just to show you how young I was. Like when people say, what do you want to do? I want to be a limousine driver. Then they say, what do you want to do? I say, I want to join the rebellion. After I saw the book, when they said, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
I would say, I want to make movies. And I mean, I've never wanted to do anything else ever. Obviously now that includes television, but that's what led to it.
Okay. And were you involved in your preteen years or in high school, like involved in the theater in any capacity? Were you writing stories, any of that?
So I wasn't involved with the theater. I did one theater thing in college and that was what it was. But I did make little movies all the time. You know, I made, 5-minute short film. And by the way, I do have to say, when it was really hard to do.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, forget about shooting on 16 or even 8mm film. The camera I had literally shot on VHS tapes. It must have been 3 or 4 feet long. Like, it was, and by the way, that was the easy part. Editing in those days, I mean, you had to buy a machine for $250 when my allowance was $5 a week. Like, I mean, it was not easy to make these films, which, by the way, were all garbage. I mean, they were terrible films. But yes, I did a lot of that. I did crappy little films in high school, a lot of them.
I imagine you're casting your neighborhood friends and your peers. And were you getting some feedback of like, hey, Brian, like, there's something special here. You're really good at this. You have some good vision. You're telling stories that need to be told, or you see things in a different way. Were you getting kind of any early feedback like that as you're starting to put together like your first content slate?
So I don't want to make it seem like my parents and friends were jerks, because they were not, but I made crappy movies and they were crappy. So nobody could look at them and truthfully say, oh, Brian, this is great. I mean, I'll tell you this. I was in show business for at least 10 years before my parents realized, oh, wow, he might have turned this into a career. Like, they were in denial my entire high school and college time that I would turn this into a career. Like I said, both of them were children of immigrants. They wanted me to be a doctor, lawyer, dentist. Like, the whole idea of going to show business with no job, I didn't know anybody when I got here. So again, their personalities, but I really do think being the offspring of immigrants that had to flee the Holocaust and everything, like, yeah. I chose a very risky career path.
Understood. Like you noted, your parents were looking for the traditional route for you, for stability, for something was familiar. For your parents, who were immigrants coming to a country that was unfamiliar to them, trying to find things that were stable and known. And you're like, no, that's not for me. I'm going to give something else a go. So you make a decision that this is the career for you. But when you go to University of Iowa, were these ambitions in your sights? Were you planning to go into the entertainment business then? What was your focus on for your studies?
Again, I never wavered for a billionth of a second from this being my career choice. Ever since I realized that Star Wars was fake. And so it was always the plan. Like I said, not only were my parents highly educated, all of my grandparents were also, my grandfather was a doctor. My other grandfather was a dentist. And even the women, which traditionally, you know, 100 years ago, were not going to schools and becoming doctors and lawyers and stuff, they were also very ambitious, very hardworking. So if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't have even gone to college. Like, I would have gone straight to LA at 18. Because of that, it never occurred to me until I was out of college, long out of college, that I could have skipped college. But I did know when I chose where I went to school, it was irrelevant to my career. So that gave me a lot of freedom not to go to NYU, not to go to UCLA. Like, I decided it was more important to me to have an experience that I could carry with me throughout my career, which I got to tell you, I think that was, in retrospect, one of the better decisions I've ever made for myself. Because, like, whenever I'm trying to look at things, should I greenlight this or should I greenlight that or whatever, I have a million friends in the Midwest. And a lot of people that I know, the majority of their friends are in LA or New York. So I get this point. I was in Minneapolis this past weekend. You know, I was like 8 or 9 people that I know there, you know. So that's who I think of when I'm making creative decisions, especially in the editing bay, by the way.
In a way, are you saying that you can empathize with a broader audience mix than maybe those that have lived and grown up in LA, or the LA consumer is all they know, where you're like, no, like, I've traveled from east to west in the Midwest. I've been in parts of the country where others have not. And I understand what they care about, what they don't care about, how they communicate with one another.
Absolutely. I mean, 100%. And just to use a non-show business example, if I only had LA and New York friends, I would have a point of view of Trump that I do not have because of my Midwest friends. I still hate the guy's guts. No offense to anyone who likes him. And I respect your opinion if you like Trump. And I think I get that because I have friends in the Midwest, because I have friends that I've known for 30 years almost that like Trump. And I understand why they like Trump. I don't agree with it. I think it's terrible, but I understand why they do. So when I see Trump, I look at him from a point of view of, again, I truly think the guy might one day be responsible for the literal actual apocalypse. But I do know that I look at him differently from almost everybody I know in LA and New York. And that is because I have friends in the Midwest that voted for him. And I understand why they did. And I know they're not racist. I know they're not anti-Semitic. It's that point of view that when I'm in an editing bay, I can think about what they care about, what they value, and not just LA, New York, and Miami.
I think that's very well said. And it's something that I feel that is an important value to me too. Like, look, I'm from the tri-state area. I grew up in Jersey, school in Boston, and then I was worked in finance in New York. And then I did go to grad school in Chicago, but then I was in LA for 10 years and now I'm in San Diego. But I feel that my time in Chicago for a couple of years, as well as the fact that my brother's wife is from Ohio and I have friends from Ohio, and sitting down with parents of my friends who have run steel mills and these manufacturing plants for over 40 years. And when I just talk politics with them, the notion of empathy is to understand their story is very different than what I hear from like my coastal friends and my coastal peers. And not making this like a political conversation or picking one side or the other, but just context and empathy, not only in the world is critical for political decisions, for economic, but in telling story and reaching different audiences and understanding what they care about and thinking about what the marketing campaign is going to be, right, is really, really critical. So I like how you've touched on that.
You just said what I think is, first of all, it's pretty much my favorite word. Second of all, I think if our country has lost anything, as everybody says we have, it's context. It's a sense of context. You know, many times people I work with, you know, trying to be nice, trying to be funny, whatever, kiss my ass a little, I don't know, but they'll write a script or something and they'll name something after me. And it's usually like a ship or a character, or spaceship, boat, whatever. And it'll be like the USS Volkweis. And I'll always say, first of all, thank you. That's very kind. Second of all, that's not me. I don't like that kind of shit. Please change the name. And if you change it, please change it to the USS Context. Because that's how much respect, that's how powerful I think that word is. Because anything is nothing if you don't take into account its surroundings. And that's why I like that word so much. And that's why, again, going back to your question, because I feel like I'm rambling, but that's why I went to Iowa. It gives me a sense of context I knew I wouldn't have if I had gone to school in LA or New York.
So yeah, going back to your decision for Iowa, was there also, in addition to context, something else that you received from that school or that experience that maybe was unexpected, but a delight you've brought with you for the rest of your life?
I learned a lot from the school. I mean, and just the experience of getting somewhere at 18 and leaving at 22, like just that experience is a great thing. But one of the things I learned, because I learned a lot, but the thing that had a lot of value to me to this day is, if you go to a school in LA or New York, for the most part, again, like UCLA or USC or an NYU, you're getting filtered in with lots of other people with the same beliefs. Another way to say it is, if I had gone to NYU, I would have been surrounded by people just like me who had made lots of student films. At Iowa, I mean, two of my best friends from Iowa, like they were from farms. They were, and by the way, that's another thing I learned, like, when you think of farm, you think of like, hey, there's a barn and a house and maybe 30 cows and a couple pigs. These people were from like I was this New York guy. My mom had a PhD. My dad was a lawyer. These people from farms, they probably made 10 times what my parents made for a living. But you don't think that way when you hear farm. So just meeting people who are the children of farmers, the first person in five generations to go to college, And they're sitting next to me in the same class on the same first day of college. Like, I took that. It's not destined that just because you make stupid films when you're in high school, that everybody else around you doing that is going to end up in the same place. You can come from a farm. You can come from a roof. You know, one of my best friends, his parents owned a roofing company. The other thing that was great about Iowa was Iowa City was very different than Iowa. So the minute you were 10 miles out, 5 miles outside of Iowa City, you might as well have been in Nebraska or Oklahoma. But Iowa City had a lot in common with New York compared to the rest of the state. So just all of that knowledge and experience, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, very well said. I think there's some themes that we can come back to there. But in moving your story forward, after Iowa, you move immediately to LA and you become a PA on Castaway.
Eventually. That wasn't my first job. My first job, I always like to say this, was an independent film called Going Back to Cali. It was a all-white producers, but it was literally an African-American copy of Swingers. This is my first job. I booked it 6 days after I got to LA. Every night, the producers would watch Swingers and the director. And then the next day, we would basically redo the same scene with an entirely African-American cast. That was my first job. I think 6 or 7 months after I got here, July. Yeah, about 4 months or 5 months later, I got Castaway.
Got it. When you made that first move and you got this first job, this, call it African-American copy of Swingers, did LA still feel right to you? Were you like, yes, this is it, I'm excited? Or were you like, actually, this is a little bit different than I thought and I'm questioning some things?
I'm not going to talk about LA because I hate LA the day I got here and I hate it now. Okay. But if you're asking me about show business, it was exactly what I thought it would be. If anything, it was more exciting, more fun, more awesome than I had even hoped it would be. I look back on those days. I know this might be a weird thing to say, but you know, I only PA'd for about a year. I was only an assistant for about a year and a half. And I'm sure if I could speak to 22 or 23-year-old Brian, they would tell me I'm smoking crack. But I wish I had PA'd a little longer. I wish I had been an assistant a little longer. Because I, especially a PA, I really enjoyed it. Like, I really, really enjoyed it. I always joke. And if there's anything I've learned about myself over the years is, as I've gotten older, a lot of times when I make the same joke over and over again, I'm not joking and I'll probably do it, but we'll see if I do it with this one. But I've always joked, maybe when I retire, I'll go back to PA. Like, I really enjoyed it.
What was it about it that you loved so much?
There were two things about it, one of which I was aware of at the time, one of which I'm sure is now me looking backwards. But at the time, what I loved was it was such a tiny job. You know, I was usually making $75 a day, but you had such an important role. Like, I'll never forget my first PA on a real job. It was a big car commercial. I'll never forget at the end of the day, you know, the whole day I got people coffee. I did all those quote unquote menial jobs, which I actually enjoyed quite a bit. But at the end of the day, I'll never forget the show. The producer handed me all the cans of film because it was film back then and said, take these to Photochem to get developed. And I was like, no problem. And he goes, never forget, every penny we spent from paper clips to producer salaries is in these cans. And I never forgot that. And that was what was so exciting. I'm 22 years old. I don't know a goddamn thing about anything. And yet I have the most important job, bringing these cans somewhere for an hour. Bringing an actress coffee may seem menial, but she needs the coffee. Like, it's very hard to be an actor.
You're delivering coffee, but you're seeing an actress preparing for when she's going to be performing. Yeah. What's her headspace? What is her routine before? What is the hair and makeup and everything that's happening in advance, you know, in advance of her going on set? So you're seeing the full experience. That absorption so early on is so valuable.
So valuable. And also a lot of fun. I mean, like, a lot of fun. And then in retrospect, looking backwards, the other thing I liked about it is it was so simple. My job now, I mean, we're planning stuff for 2024. Almost everything we do now if not everything we do now, is connected to other things. So we're not just putting out a TV show. We're putting out a TV show, a book, and a podcast. When you're a PA, they say, yo, go to Walmart, buy a hammer. You go to Walmart, you buy a hammer, you go back. They say, thank you. And then they tell you to do something else. And it's just very A to B, A to B, A to B. And yeah, I miss that.
I hear that. It reminds me of a story. There was this very famous IP lawyer that had a very complicated job, dealt with complicated legal cases. And on the weekends, to relax and decompress, all he wanted, like you said, Brian, was the simplest tasks and actions. So he got himself a bulldozer in his backyard, and he would literally just move mounds of dirt. A mound of dirt from one corner of the yard to the other, do that for 4 hours on a Saturday. That's how he cleared his brain.
I get that. Like, you wouldn't even believe. Like, I might go buy a fucking bulldozer now. I totally get it. That's brilliant.
And I hear you. Look, as an owner of a smaller business than yours, just the weight of the responsibility, taking care of your team, taking care of your clients, making sure that you have payroll, you know, you're planning years ahead. I hear you. So what are the simple things that you do to keep your sanity?
Honestly, buy toys, collect. It's like going to church or temple or whatever. It's so peaceful to me to walk around a vintage toy store and just see what they have and buy some things, you know, bring them home and put them in my collection. People have every right to say I'm hoarding. I get it. I mean, the volume in which I'm buying toys is, I know it's ridiculous, but it gives me tremendous joy just exploring vintage toy stores, even antique stores. Like, it really gives me a lot of peace, even if I don't buy anything. Like, just seeing the way the world was, seeing little bits of history. You know, you'll see an ashtray from Bell and Root, knowing that'll eventually become Halliburton. You know, just seeing that in a store, you know, an antique store, like, that gives me a lot of peace.
When you go shopping or looking at vintage toys and vintage items, do you like to do that alone? Do you do that with certain peers that are also aficionados?
My favorite way to do it is alone. Well, that's not true. The only exception to that is my wife, because my wife is just like me. If we go to an antique store, she doesn't want to talk until we're walking out. So I don't talk to her. She don't talk to me. We just shop and explore. But most people, you know, they want to talk and everything. And I'm very focused. Like, I'm really focused on what I'm looking at. The exception to the rule, even though it's not helpful to my relaxing, is, of course, with my kids. You know, it's the opposite of what my wife and I do. But I love my kids like any father does. But they're just so fucking funny that it's worth the distraction being with them because of how funny they are.
Going back to your career trajectory. So after being a PA and then you're on Castaway, you break into, I think, BKEG Talent Management. And there you start managing comedians and then you start producing stand-up comedy specials. And it kind of kicks off this incredible run that you have there and then through New Wave Entertainment, which I think acquired BKEG in 2003. So I'm curious, right now with like the creator economy, where every major social and incumbent platform and all the major streamers, they realize that the talent, the creators, they bring the audience and thereby the audience then brings the money and the revenue. When you started working with talent early on, what were some of your key learnings? How did you gravitate towards them? And why did you start working with comedians in particular?
I started working with comedians completely randomly. It was all random. I'd only been in a comedy club once in my life before I went to BKEG. I was interning at a tiny company that there was on the floor that his office was at. There was a communal copy room and all the assistants to all the producers and other people in the floor would get to know each other because you would be in the copy room copying stuff together and you'd have to wait while people were using the machine. All I knew was this guy I knew was leaving his job. He needed to replace himself. He was making $50 cash a day under the table. That's all I knew about the job. I knew that I was broke. I had saved up about $3,000 during college. I had burnt through the $3,000. I was about to start waiting tables on the weekend. I was still PAing, even though I was an intern 5 days a week. I had still been PAing on the weekends, but I still was burning through my money. So I met with his boss and I just needed the $50 a day cash so I didn't become a waiter again because I waited tables in college. And I got the job. And about a week into the job, I understood what a manager, I didn't even know what a manager was when I took the job. It was a tiny management company. I basically was like, I can't think of a worse job than being a manager. So I basically gave my 2 weeks notice. The owner of the company, a guy named Barry basically said, what do you want to do for a living? And I was like, I want to produce movies. And he was like, well, as a manager, you can do that. And he started walking me through how you do that. So I stuck with it. Then I started managing. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, the first movie I ever got on into a movie theater was through a client. The first show I ever sold on television was through a client. And the entire foundation of our company is from that process. To answer your other question, you know, I understood talent very quickly. It was very easy to understand. They're not like the rest of us. And as a manager or somebody who becomes a manager or is thinking of becoming a manager, you have to make peace with that or not do the job. Because if you're a manager for any other profession, you just say the obvious thing and you tell your client what to do. So if I was managing engineers and I had a client working at Boeing and my client was like, I'm mad at my boss. I'm not going to work today. I'd be like, well, you work for Boeing. You got to go to work. You're going to be fired. Like, it doesn't matter what you think of your boss. With an actor, you can't say that, nor should you. Because I cannot tell you this enough. The amount of clients, like I had clients I talked to every day. I would go on vacations with them. I would go to movies with them on the weekends. These were people I talked to 7 days a week, 18 hours a day, that kind of stuff. And I would still be on set with them and we're just hanging out like friends. And then the second AD comes over and is like, hey, so-and-so, you're up. And they would go and start doing a scene. And I'm like looking at them like they're levitating or flying or can split at. Like it never wore off on me how amazing it is that people can become other people. Like I know this sounds like insane. I've been doing this for 23 years and I'm still amazed that actors can act. But I made peace with that on day one. And for me at the time, because pretty much all my clients were stand-up comedians, they're complicated people, but you have to be complicated to become a stand-up comedian. You also have to be a genius. There is no stand-up comedian I've ever met that can sell 100 tickets or more that wasn't a genius. So when they say they're not getting out of bed for any reason, you have to engage with them, find out the reason, and then work with the studio or the network or the producers or the director to get them simpatico.
Yeah.
So, and I enjoyed that because I respected how hard it was to do what they did.
Hey, listeners, this is Chris Irwin, your host of The Come Up. I have a quick ask for you. If you dig what we're putting down, if you like the show, if you like our guests, it would really mean a lot if you can give us a rating wherever you listen to our show. It helps other people discover our work, and it also really supports what we do here. All right, that's it, everybody. Let's get back to the interview. I'm hearing two things from you, Brian, that I think are really interesting. One, which speaks to the longevity of your career and why I believe there's so much more ahead, is because it really feels like, just from talking the last 30 minutes, how much you love what you do. When you were describing Star Wars and your early impressions of Batman and making movies as a teenager and in high school, and then even just describing back then working with talent, watching them instantly transform on set and that like that wow factor for you, and then you still have that same feeling today, it's that you're captivated by entertainment in Hollywood. And that's even if you despise LA, you love the entertainment industry, you love show business, and I don't think that star is ever going to fade. It feels like it's just going to get brighter for you.
I will say this. This could sound like a metaphor. This could sound like I'm trying to be humble. I don't know. But I'm telling you, I mean this. The way I tell you the sky is blue, when I tell you I cannot believe any of this is happening to this day, I mean it. I mean, I absolutely mean it. I'm shocked any of this worked. Absolutely shocked. So much of what we've built was theoretical for so long. And the fact that there's almost no greater feeling, not connected to family, there's almost no greater feeling than watching the moment a theory becomes a fact. And, you know, we were making stand-up specials at scale, 20 to 30 a year, for years, spending millions and millions of dollars. 99.9 cents of every dollar that came in for 5 or 6 years, we spent that money on making stand-up specials. We didn't know if it would work or not, probably until year 7. We started this plan in 08, and I didn't know it would work for sure until 2014.
Well, that speaks to an interesting point that we were talking about before this recording. What was the catalyst that caused you to keep reinvesting in these comedy specials? Why were you putting 99.9 cents of every dollar that you brought in back into this growing body of work?
Well, there's two answers to that question. The first answer is the long-term answer, which is I knew the day I got here, you know, again, I was 22 years old, but I'd been thinking about this since I was 5. I wanted to build a studio. That was always my goal. I always wanted to build a studio. And I had read about how all the other studios had been built. I knew Disney was built on Donald and Mickey and all of that. I knew Warner Brothers was built on this Max Sennett library. And that was the key word, library. So I knew I had to build a library. And if I wanted to build a studio, I knew I needed a library. I didn't know how to build a library. A bunch of lucky things happened. The first lucky thing was, like I said, as a manager, you make a stand-up special for your clients once or twice a year. So one day I get a call from an agent, a guy named Mike Berkowitz. And at the time I was a manager. I had all my clients and I was managing full-time. And then 98% of my job was managing, 2% was producing. And I got a call from Mike, and Mike asked me if I would ever produce a stand-up special for a non-client. And I was really offended. And if I'm being honest with you, I was kind of rude to him. I'm like, it was Michael Ian Black's agent. And I said to him, I'm like, dude, why are you calling me about producing a special? Like I'm not good enough to manage him? Why can't I manage him? And I was really annoyed about it. The next day in the shower, I suddenly remembered my job was to make money. And it, as long as it was legal, it didn't really matter how I made the money. So I called Mike back and I apologized. And luckily he forgave me, which if you knew Mike, this doesn't happen very often. No offense, Mike, but it's true. You would agree with me if you ever hear this. That being said, we did Michael Ian Black special, and word got out to the community that we were making specials for non-clients. So that was the first thing that happened. The second thing that happened was in 2006, I read a book called The Long Tail. And the reason anytime I talk about The Long Tail, I always mention what year I read it. 2006 was a very important year, not because of what happened, but because of what would happen. The book correctly predicted the rise of YouTube, iPhones, streaming, everything, AVOD, SVOD, everything. So I took the biggest risk of my entire life, and I bet everything that that book would be right. Because the truth of the matter is, one of my clients blew up. I mean, I started working with this guy when he could sell 400 tickets. And like 3 years later, he was selling 15 to 25,000 tickets a night. He was making $1 million a show. And I could have taken that money and put it in the bank, invested it. And I'd probably have more money now than I do if I had done that. But the other thing is, in addition to wanting to build a studio since I was a little kid, it was always very important to me to leave something behind. I didn't want to die and not have contributed something, anything but something to the world. And basically, I bet everything that the book would be right. And I'll be completely honest with you. When I made the decision, I basically said to myself, this is it. If the book's right, I'll be able to achieve my dream. If the book is wrong, I'll have to quit or get fired and either become an agent at a big agency or go back to school and, you know, become a lawyer or something. I knew I was making a bet it all bet. By good Lord, the grace of God, that book could not have been more accurate and correct in what it predicted.
Well, because I think when you read that in 06, Brian, and then your investment in this stand-up comedy special library from 08 through the next 6 to 10 plus years, that also led to growing credibility for you to start going into unscripted and scripted work and TV series and film projects. And then eventually you being able to launch your own production company and studio Nacelle in 2017.
That's exactly right. I mean, it killed a million birds with one stone. One of the most important birds that literally changed the course of my life, the company's trajectory, everything, was I do not know anybody in my entire life that did a deal with Netflix before me. My first deal with Netflix was in March of 2009. I swear to you, you're going to think I'm joking. I am not joking. I signed a contract. It kept the contract said all over the contract, streaming, 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 SVOD, SVOD, SVOD. I hadn't a clue what that meant. Not an iota of a fucking clue. But the deal was for so much money, I didn't want to risk losing it. So I just signed it. And that deal did two things. First of all, it brought in the money that allowed me to keep growing the company, because that deal was for the rights to specials I had already made, had already aired elsewhere, like Comedy Central or Showtime. And these rights had reverted. And that's the deal I had done with Netflix. We didn't even have Netflix in my house. Like, I'd never seen, when I signed that contract, I hadn't even seen Netflix yet.
It was a DVD company. I think Netflix was founded around, 98, 99? And then like 8 to 10 years in, probably exactly the time frame you're describing of 09, there was this slow transition to streaming. But I don't even know if it happened at that date yet. They were probably just starting to put that into contracts and planning for the future.
It had happened.
Okay.
But first of all, nobody really understood it. But second of all, the first person I ever met at Netflix, this woman named Lisa Nishimura, when I met with Lisa, they were in the middle of their biggest crisis up until this very second. They were going through, I forgot what it was called, like Flickster or Flickr. They were dividing their DVD business from their streaming business, which nobody understood because nobody knew what streaming was. So it was this whole like, what? So, but the reason I bring this up is that deal I did with Netflix in 2009 got me in the door with them before almost anybody. And because of that, I met this guy named Devin Griffin. And Devin had a very unique job where Devin, he was the guy that whenever we had the rights to a special ending at Comedy Central or something, or we had a special that we shot without a buyer. And again, I feel like that's worth mentioning. To this day, other people I'm friends with who own production companies will say, even though they know our plan worked, they will still say to me, it is insane that you were making stand-up specials with no buyers at scale. Almost everybody I know would try it once or twice and then quit. Part of how I got through it and survived the risk was we did it at scale. You can't make one or two at a time. You have to make 5 to 10 at a time, which means instead of spending 300 grand, you're spending 5 to 10 million. So when I tell you we bet it all, I mean, we fucking bet it all. But the reason I bring this up is we were doing this at a time when no one else was. So even though we were tiny, Netflix had no choice but to work with us because we were the only independent company that had a stand-up comedy library. So I knew this Devin Griffin guy because who's now a very good friend of mine for a lot of reasons, by the way. He's the smartest person I know, but he also changed the course of my life. He was transferred after a couple years from stand-up comedy acquisitions to Unscripted. And he was the guy who was like, what do you got? I had been trying to sell this show, which eventually was called The Toys That Made Us, for 7 years. I never could sell it because a lot of people don't understand this, but producers are typecast just like actors. So I couldn't sell it because I was always the stand-up comedy guy and people, executives and buyers were always like, why is the stand-up comedy guy trying to sell me a show about toys? But because I knew Devin, because I was friends with Devin. Devin had been to my house and Devin had seen my toy collection. So, and he also knew me, like he knew he could trust, take my word. Like, so if I told him I could do X and he knew I was a quote unquote expert in toys, he greenlit Toys That Made Us and had changed everything for the company overnight.
And when you say why it changed things for the company overnight, was it because of the money that was coming in from that deal? Was it the prominence of that, how popular it became on Netflix? And then what came thereafter, which is the movies that made us? What was that transformation?
It changed a lot of things for a lot of different reasons. The first thing it did was, I mean, it was our first hit. I mean, we had never made anything that resonated in pop culture ever. So just by having a hit, not only do you get phone calls returned faster, but it's easier to sell shows once you have a hit. So that's the first thing it changed. The second thing it changed was it gave the company an identity for the first time other than stand-up comedy. The third thing it did, and I think a lot of people might even say this is the most important thing it did, Toys That Made Us was the first show we ever sold that was about a passion that I had. Every other show before that, and we probably had over a dozen shows on the air before Toys That Made Us, not a single one of those shows got a second season. If you go on IMDb or Amazon, like they're all like 3 stars to 5 stars. What I learned, and you might be like, it's really pathetic, Brian, you had to learn this the hard way, but before Toys That Made Us, I would do research on what the buyers want and then develop shows based on that research. And then I would make those shows to pay the bills. What Toys That Made Us showed me was, I don't know, if I cared about the show and was passionate about the topic, call me crazy, but we'd probably do a better job. So after Toys That Made Us came out, we haven't done anything that we're not passionate about. And knock on wood, not a single show that we've made since Toys That Made Us has not gotten at least a second season. That's what we learned.
I love that. So then the natural follow-up question is, with that new intention, let's create programming that stems from what we love as individuals, what we love as a team, what we're passionate about. Beyond just instilling that in your own mental framework, how did you instill that amongst your team? How did you change your development process to do that?
Well, I mean, it was pretty easy because A, almost everybody that works at the company is some degree of a geek. And by the way, I have to say, I'm very proud of this. The few people that have joined us that are not geeks, well, guess what they are usually 6 months later. We hired this awesome executive from Discovery. This poor girl, oh my God. I mean, she didn't have a fucking toy to her name the day she joined us. I mean, I think she has a shelf of toys now, and I guarantee you she'll have probably 5 shelves of toys by the end of 2022. But anyway, I just love that. But anyway, so we just shifted into what we loved. I mean, it was such an obvious move, but I missed it. So basically after Toys That Made Us came out and we were getting incoming phone calls for the first time ever, I was like, yeah, you know how we all love this geek shit? Let's just do that. And that's not all we do, but it really became what we became known for. And, you know, it's funny, the exception to this, of course, is Down to Earth with Zac Efron. That's not a pop culture show. But it was the same premise where I love Zach. I love that he was so excited about the environment and food. And it was just very easy for us to get passionate about that because, I mean, who's not passionate about food and the environment?
And I think, look, a powerful thing, this is a theme from a lot of the other entrepreneurs and leaders I talk to, it's just focus. And if you're trusting your gut, you're focusing on a more narrow lane. It also impacts who you recruit. Recruiting team members that are like, look, we want to find people who are nerds like us that deeply love things. If I was recruiting to be hired by your company, Brian, I'd be like, yeah, that's the type of team I want to work for. Where you're hiring me for my taste and what I love, and you're going to help make that come to life, and we could sell shows like that to Netflix and the other streamers, I'm going to be pumped to join you than probably some of the other studios. And it focuses the conversations around the table, and it focuses you as a leader for, you can probably really push your team and say, do you really care about this topic? Do you really love it? Give me more. I sense that you're leaving something on the table here and you got to dig deeper. That's powerful.
That's exactly right. We just do what we're passionate about. Don't get me wrong. We're not idiots. Like if I don't think I can sell it or I don't think the public will want to watch it, Yeah, we're not going to do it. This is the other thing I always like to say. Sam Raimi had this great quote in 2000 when he was directing Spider-Man. I never forget this. It's like a real rule for us. He goes, this is before the movie came out. He said, I'm making Spider-Man. I'm not making Sam Raimi Spider-Man. And I'm very passionate about what we make, but I never forget that we are making a product to be shared. And I don't want to make something that people won't like or be excited about. And by the way, sometimes we try and sometimes we fail. But, you know, we got a lot of criticism on a show we made once. I'll tell you the whole story. We put out a show last year on Amazon called A Toy Store Near You. And the first season, every episode, it takes place in toy stores all over the world. The first season, every episode was like 25% about the toys, 75% about how the stores were staying in business during COVID. It was a pretty deep, dark show. We put it out. We think we've made a great show. We're all happy. We're all excited. And the feedback, I mean, it was like 80% negative. And of the 80% negative, everybody was basically saying some version of this. My life sucks. I'm depressed. Every news story I see is bad. When I watch TV, I don't want to be reminded about COVID. I want to forget about COVID. So we were in production on season two. And I think a lot of directors may have been like, fuck you. This is our show. I was horrified that I had misjudged the public so badly. And if you watch season two is the opposite. It's 75% toys, 25% COVID. Season three is 99.9% toys, 0.1% COVID. And we're in post right now on season four. We literally just reshot something last week because you could see someone in the background wearing a mask. So we do listen and we do take all that stuff very serious with the public things.
Well, look, I think that speaks to one of the earlier themes of our conversation, Brian, which was context and empathy. I think it's why Ted Lasso performed so well during COVID. People just wanted to escape. They wanted to smile, feel good content. And that was exactly that. And just, you know, speaking from personal experience, 9/11 happened. Recently, there was a lot of amazing documentaries on the 20-year anniversary. On Netflix, on the other streamers, I started watching the one on Netflix. Being from the tri-state area, it really hits close to home. And I was like, look, being in COVID, feeling isolated, the whole world going through tough times, I just can't see content like this right now. This is not what I'm looking for. Not saying that that content's not valuable and that I want to come back and visit it, but that wasn't the right moment in time for me. Hearing you say that, Brian, I think it's like, yeah, it's that constant balance of staying true to you, of telling the stories that are important to what you think the world should hear, but also like, what do people want to hear right now? And I want to cater to that as well, which also drives longevity for your business. And it reminds me, we had Allison Akel on the podcast, I think a couple months ago. She's the head of development at Shondaland. And she always says, when I'm creating a show, I think of what's the movie poster? What's the marketing going to be? Just as the ideas are coming together. And that just causes you to think, what is the audience reaction going to be? It's like when I went to business school at Kellogg, the way that they teach leadership and business management is through the marketing lens. Marketing as a management philosophy, and marketing is all about understanding the customer mindset. So I really like how you capture that there.
Thank you. And by the way, my best friend in college, Jamie Jackson, he went to business school. All I did for 4 years was make fun of him for that. Oh, how was business today? Yeah. What kind of business did you talk about?
Yeah.
By the way, I went to communications and I was cutting 16mm film together and taping it together with Scotch tape, something that would have 0.0 value the day I graduated. Guess what I should have studied in college in retrospect?
Well, at the least, you can hire people on your team that can now do this.
Thank God.
This has been such a fun conversation because we'll bring up different questions. And then Brian, you just go off on these amazing stories and vignettes, which have been awesome. But we did gloss over the point about your belief that the top comedians are really geniuses.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I didn't say the top comedians. I very deliberately said anyone who can sell 100 tickets, which is nothing. I mean, that is nothing. Any comedian that gets to the point where they can sell, where you have 100 people in a market paying money to see them. That is a low bar, but anyone who gets to that point is a genius. It's not just the top comics. It includes them, but you cannot get to a point where 100 people are hiring babysitters and paying for two drinks unless you're a genius.
Thank you for the clarification. That further even reemphasizes my point.
Yeah, I didn't mean to jump on you, but I it's important to me to say that because so hard is that job that I just want to make it very clear. Long before you're selling out arenas, you need to be a genius.
I have not followed comedians for my like entire life, but I can admit that over the past, call it 3 to 5 years, I've really followed Bill Burr very closely. And I'm actually going to see him in Long Beach tomorrow night. And then also through some advisory work that we've done with Team Coco and Conan O'Brien's digital team, starting to pay more attention to what Conan does and his podcasts and his interviews. And I think what is so unique about comedians, yes, whether they're the top or they're just starting to build their careers, their ability to observe human behavior and society and have really interesting commentary, I think is unparalleled. And in a writing class that I take with my brother, great writers just observe. And through great observation, they can make very interesting literary points and stories. And I look at the comedians today where like I just watched the recent Dave Chappelle special on Netflix. And despite the controversy that that has driven, his ability to observe and see things that others do not and then talk about it in ways that others do not, I think that's very valuable for society and something that's treasured. And I look at them, Brian, with awe. And I'm like, how do they see that? So I that's something I wanted to highlight.
Like I said, I talk to comedians every day. I already talked to Tom Papa this morning. I was talking to Steve Byrne 2 days ago. Like I talk to comedians every day. I was with Jim Gaffigan in Minneapolis on Saturday. Like I have never gotten over who they are and what they do. Yeah, they're geniuses. But I'll tell you something. Everything you said is right. There's nothing I'm disagreeing with. But I'll tell you something on top of that that I think is also true, maybe. Yes, you need to be a genius. Yes, you need to observe, but you also need to understand how the public perceives you. So what works for Bill Burr wouldn't work for Chappelle. What Chappelle does wouldn't work for Bill Burr. Like they had to find not only who they were, but who the audience thought they were. And I'll tell you how I learned this lesson. So like I told you earlier, I used to represent this guy that went from selling 400 tickets to 15,000 tickets very quickly. I mean, over the course of 3 years, that's how big he jumped. And I was with him 4 to 7 nights a week in the clubs, at the shows, everything. I had his act memorized. And I mean memorized, not just the words. I had the intonations up and down. Like I had his act. One day, we had a mutual friend who was preparing to be on, I believe, Conan. Might have been Kimmel, but doesn't matter. And he was practicing his set at this place called the Gower Gulch, which is a karaoke bar that had every Wednesday night, they had a open mic night. The crowd was very light and it was late and they were waiting for people to come in. But Jay, our friend, didn't want to go up because the crowd wasn't big enough yet. And he didn't want to do his test in front of 6 people. So my client says to me, hey, you know my act. Why don't you go up and do my act? And I'm like, sure. Oh, my God. I can't even believe you're letting me do this. Like, that is such a no-no in the comedy community. Even though I'm not a comedian, like, you do not do someone's act. You do not, like, you don't do it. And I cannot stress this enough. This night I'm talking about, he was one of the biggest comedians of all time. So this was not a small person asking me to do this. He was a stadium act at that point. So I go up cocky, you know, whatever. And I'm like, dude, it didn't work for me. I knew every single word of his act. I knew every pause. I knew when to go up, when to go down on the pronunciation. To say I bombed, this was a set that could make 15,000 people laugh simultaneously. And by the way, not just every single time. He could do 80 shows in a row with that exact same 20 minutes and never not get a standing ovation. I did it once. I gave up. I was like, all right, thank you. I didn't even finish the 20 minutes.
Couldn't even get through it.
Thank you. Tip your waitstaff. So I always think that's very important to say that it's not just about the genius. It's not just about the material. There are comedians I know who are geniuses that have great material that have been doing it, I kid you not, for 30 plus years that still have not figured out what the audience wants them to be and who they want to be. And, you know, they've been doing it for 30 years. They still can't sell 100 tickets.
I really like that. And I just have to ask in closing, Brian, how did it feel for you to bomb? Because I imagine, like, Bill Burr talks about this all the time on his Monday morning podcast. You have to get your reps in. You have to know what it's like to go to bomb because you have to try. And only through failure will you learn what your relationship is with the audience, when you feel comfortable, what your style is. So for you going up there where you thought you had like the best jokes in the world, what did that feel like?
Well, I did have the best jokes in the world because I didn't write them.
Yeah.
The guy who could sell arenas did. I mean, I was laughing my head off. Like, I mean, I never wanted to be on stage. I never wanted to be a comedian. I didn't give a shit. I mean, it was like a really funny experiment, but and this I only learned a day, a week, a month later, but it did give me that experience because think about it. Like, there's no flight instructor in history teaching people how to fly planes that did not already know how to fly planes. So think about how weird it is to be a manager that only represents comedians and you've never been on stage telling a joke. So some, it wasn't early in my career. It was probably barely halfway through the management part of my career, but to have that knowledge, and I've used it the rest of my life. Yes, it was very valuable.
Brilliant. Love that. All right. So let's talk about what's the future of Nacelle Company. This business is now around 4 years old, founded in January 2017. You were just highlighting before the break some incredible traction that you have. What are you thinking about in terms of what's next? And I think you've recently read a book, again, the second time in your career, that's really inspired some big future moves. Tell us about that.
So the future for our company is there's two things we're basically doing right now. And if I had to guess, this will be the two things we're doing for the rest of time. The first thing is we're taking knowledge we have and experience and revenue from an existing business and applying it to bigger and better things. So the example I can give you is we started making stand-up specials on spec, meaning we didn't have a buyer lined up, and then we sold them or licensed them. We didn't sell them. We licensed them, which is like, for those that don't know, that's a temporary rental of our title. So we did that with stand-up comedy. You know, we've been doing that now for about 15 years. Now what we're doing, and the first attempt at this was Down to Earth with Zac Efron. We are doing with series what we used to do with stand-up specials, but we're right now only doing it in unscripted series. So we have a show coming out in 2 weeks on History Channel called The Center Seat, which is 10 episodes only about Star Trek. We own that show. We have a book coming out the same day and a podcast coming out the same day. And after a certain amount of time, History Channel will not have access to that show and the rights will revert back to us, just like we did with stand-up comedy. So that's what we're doing now. And this is obviously much more expensive, making series on spec than making stand-up specials. I mean, every at-bat is seven figures. Whereas in comedy, I would say 70% of our at-bats are under seven figures, 30% or above seven figures. With series, it's all above seven figures in the future. And we're doing that right now. A toy store near you, same thing. We own that show. In the future, we're going to go from doing one or two a year, God willing, to doing 10 to 20 series a year. Combined with, we will then get into scripted and we'll start doing the same thing in scripted. So spending $5 million an episode on spec, just like Sony. Just like Lionsgate. And then after that, and maybe simultaneously, we'll be doing the same thing with movies. The moment where, if I had to guess, the beginning of my retirement will start is the point where we greenlight our first, say, $100 million movie. Like, the minute that happens, I will probably be retired within probably about 5 years after that event. So that's the first answer. The second answer is, I'm a big believer, and I get this, a lot of this comes back to Walt and Roy Disney. I'm a big believer in the flywheel method, which, since you went to Kellogg, you know what I mean, but I only learned about this in my early 40s, where we are launching departments to service other departments. So that allows us to put out, like I said, we're going to put out a show on History Channel in 2 weeks, but we're also getting revenue from the podcast. We're also getting revenue from the book, yada, yada, yada. So two answers. Answer one, just keep doing what we're doing, but do it bigger and better. Answer number two, create more departments to monetize what we're already doing. And I just want to say, for the record, monetizing sounds like some big fancy word. I mean, to say that we're all having the time of our lives launching a publishing arm, not knowing a goddamn thing about publishing, that kind of shit's a lot of fun. But I've been through that cycle now a lot. When we launched our stand-up arm, we didn't know what we were doing. When we launched our record arm, which now is to say it's the number one producer of stand-up comedy audio is a tremendous understatement. We didn't know what the hell we were doing. So, I mean, I never have any fear about not knowing what I'm doing, for better or worse. The book you refer to, I just read it probably about less than 6 months ago. Really boring title. It's called Liftoff, but it's a great book about the first 10 years of SpaceX. But it's funny. The reason I find that book so valuable is the exact opposite of the long tail. With the long tail, it showed me a possible path forward. With Liftoff, again, I cannot stress this enough, I did not go to business school. So almost everything we're doing is just me trusting my gut and praying to God it works. What Liftoff showed me was a lot of what we're doing is the right thing to do. And what a lot of people don't understand about SpaceX, and I'll be honest with you, I didn't understand this either until I read the book. I mean, what Elon Musk started with SpaceX conservatively was the 15th time a rich person tried to build a space launching company. Every single person and company that tried before him failed. And a lot of the reasons why he succeeded, we were already doing. But I didn't know if it was right or not. And his book showed me some of the things that we were doing, which were extremely unusual. And even I was questioning, is this smart or stupid? His book showed me it was the right path. And that we, and I mean, the example I like to give is we develop almost all of our internal capabilities. We try to do things outside of the company as little as possible. I have a tendency to have a vendor and then either hire the vendor or buy the company that was providing the service, because I like to have everything under one roof. Elon Musk, in the book, it tells a great story where they needed these special kind of pumps. They're called turbo pumps to mix the fuels to get the rocket into the out of the atmosphere. There's two companies on the planet, one of which is American, that make turbo pumps for everybody, NASA, Boeing, JPL, everybody. Because Elon Musk was the new kid on the block, he was getting them slowly, and they were coming and they still needed work. And then SpaceX's engineers had to actually finish working on them. Musk eventually said, fuck it, we're just going to start making our own turbo pumps. That led to a lot of things. First of all, they didn't have supply problems anymore with a vendor. Second of all, they were able to make them at 30% the cost of the other company. Fourth of all, guess what SpaceX now sells to other space companies? Turbo pumps.
They've become a supplier themselves. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what Amazon did with their cloud service. Like, so I have long been a believer in having as many capabilities under our roof as possible. And for those that don't run a business, you like, that's very risky and expensive. You know, every time your payroll goes up, it's risky. But my theory has always been, if it's all unified under one roof, we will make more money because everybody's talking to everybody all the time.
Totally agree. This reminds me of a conversation that we were having with a direct-to-consumer retailer this year. And the challenge was their board and investors are thinking about, okay, we have this growth vision, but if we want to minimize the amount of capital that we're putting to work up front, how can we outsource some of these capabilities so that if things don't work, we're not on the hook versus this massive investment in fixed costs? And I was like, I hear that. I totally get that. But the challenge is you're not creating internal capabilities, intelligence, and commitment to your internal teams that this is where you really want to go in the future. And so the quality of your effort, the quality of this business initiative is going to be inferior and will not necessarily outperform who you're trying to beat in the marketplace if it's just all outsourced from day one. So I think what you described is very on point.
Absolutely. And by the way, I'll give you a great example. Every company out there, in theory, that owns an amusement park, in theory, has their own version of the Imagineers. That is not true. The Imagineering department at Disney is over 2,000 people, highly paid, highly skilled. There's a guy in the Imagineering department, all he does for a living, I guarantee you he gets paid six figures. All he does is design better fake rock technology. There is an Imagineer. All she does is create better, more realistic looking leaves from foam. That is all she does 52 weeks a year, minus vacation time. But my point is, no other amusement park has that capability. And I think Disney might make more than every single amusement park on the planet combined. I could be wrong, but even if I'm wrong, I'm probably not wrong by that much. And I completely agree with you. Anytime I hear a company is divesting and blah, 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 I'm always like, this is either the beginning of the end or they will reverse that decision when the next CEO comes to fix the mistake you've made by trying to have a better quarter. Because that's the problem these companies make when they do that. Like, all they care about is beating the same quarter the prior year. That is a recipe for failure.
I agree. I think the other key variable here that makes SpaceX, that makes Disney perform, and then also the future for you, Brian, with Nacelle, is you have to have a leader, which then flows down to the team, really believe in this business initiative. If it's like, hey, we're kind of into this, we were going to outsource some of the stuff, but we're going to bring it in-house. But if you're not bringing the passion, the focus to your team every day after that massive investment in fixed costs, it's not going to work. And that really comes from the top. And from this conversation, Brian, I can feel that from you as a leader of your business and as a visionary for the industry that you're in. And I hear you. Like, we just hired another person on our team. That's replacing a couple contractors that we used to have supporting us. Good. That scares me. Smart. It's like, I got more mouths to feed. That's more of a commitment for me to do business development. But I know in my gut, it's the right move if I want this company to grow. So we are simpatico on that level.
You went to Kellogg, I didn't. So take it with a grain of salt, but I believe you're right.
So Brian, before going into rapid fire, I just want to give some kudos to you. I have really only gotten to know you through this interview and a little bit of prep before. And it feels like to me that you are really fulfilling your destiny as a creator and storyteller, which I put the different interviews of people that I have on the podcast together. And I just had Doug Bernstein from House of Highlights. And that's a new social media native sports brand. Doug was all about sports since like age three. And I told him at the end of the show, I was like, you are fulfilling your destiny now running House of Highlights. And who knows where this is going to go. And Brian, I now look at you and telling me that your earliest memories and your reaction of Star Wars and Batman, building this company, being a crap creator when you were in high school, despite your family and friends' feedback, but trusting your gut the entire way and then going out on your own after an amazing 16-year career with BKEG and New Wave, it really honestly feels to me, Brian, that you are just getting started on what you're doing. And I have a gut sense that even though you say that, you know, 5 years after you have this $100 million green light for your first feature, I think that's going to come to you a lot sooner than you expect. And I actually don't think that you fully understand where your business is going to be in the content landscape in 10 years from now. It's been a delight to get to know you, and I wish you really the best going forward.
You're very kind, man. I hope you're right. My wife would agree with you, but yeah, like I said, it's all surreal. I'm shocked we've even gotten this far, and I really, really, really mean that.
Rapid fire, 6 questions. The rules are that the answers will be one sentence or maybe just 1 to 2 words. Do you understand the rules?
I understand the rules.
Okay. Here we go. Proudest life moment.
My third born coming home and my wife and first 2 kids all being in bed together with our third kid.
I love it. What do you want to do less of in 2022?
Driving and flying.
What do you want to do more of?
Making toys. We're making toys now, and I want to make more toys.
What one thing drives your success?
Utterly fearless when it comes to failure. I know failure will come, and I'm not afraid of it. And when it does come, I still get out of bed in the morning and fight.
Advice for media execs going into 2022.
Do not be afraid of failure.
Any future startup ambitions that you think are maybe outside the confines of your current company?
Buy a one screen movie theater and just play my favorite movies. And it would probably have a pizzeria connected to it.
With pizzeria. I just have to ask, what would be 3 movies that would be part of that rotation?
Star Wars, A New Hope, 89 Batman, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Got it. Last question. This is an easy one. How can people get in contact with you?
Instagram and Facebook. It's my name. You know, it's not some wacky, weird thing. That's it. Yeah. Brian Volkweiss at Instagram or whatever.
All right. That's it, Brian. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. Dude, this was awesome, man.
Thanks for the time. Much appreciated. Later.
Thank you. Hope to see you soon.
Super fun conversation with Brian, and a funny timing. The day after we recorded that, I actually went and saw Bill Burr do stand-up in Long Beach. And I believe that Brian has worked with Bill in the past. It was a phenomenal experience. And I highly recommend that if Bill Burr is coming to a city near you guys, go check him out. Definitely worth it. All right. Lastly, our team was in New York last week. We hosted an event for investors and founders in the media and commerce industries. It was awesome. Had a great time. We're going to do another one in the first quarter of 2022. This one will be on the West Coast, though, in LA, and likely going to have a live stream commerce theme. I know we've been talking about this for a couple of years now, but now's the time to do it as things are opening up. So stay tuned for that. All right, everybody. Thanks again for listening. The Come Up is written and hosted by me, Chris Irwin, and is a production of Rockwater Industries. Please rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts. And remember to subscribe wherever you listen to our show. And if you really dig us, feel free to forward the Come Up to a friend. You can sign up for our company newsletter at wearerockwater.com/newsletter. And you could follow us on Twitter at TCUpod. The Come Up is engineered by Daniel Turek. Music is by Devin Bryant. Logo and branding is by Kevin Zazali. And special thanks to Andrew Cohen and Mike Booth from the Rockwater team.